Today is Wednesday. It's April 20th, 2022. It's 2:38 in the afternoon. Hello, this is John Williams, and you're listening to the Mincing Rascals. It's a podcast we record on Wednesdays, and remember, you can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
Hey, it's John Hansen from It's All Good, a Block Club Chicago podcast, on the block at WCIU, and on WGN Radio's Monday through Thursday at 6 and Saturday afternoons.
Wow. I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
I'm Eric Zorn, the proprietor of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter, and I am spelunking for pleasure this week.
Spelunking. Why are you spelunking, Eric?
Spelunking. Well, because yesterday, Governor Pritzker, in his announcement of the budget, was raging at Republicans. He said, we're spelunking for misery. Because they were looking for bad news in his budget. So I am spelunking, yeah, exploring the deepest, darkest caves.
I knew you would have looked it up. I thought spelunking was climbing mountains, but that's going down into caves. Is that right?
Yes, going down into caves. So
spelunking for pleasure sounds like one of those weird suburban love hotels. Is what
I'm talking about. I will not confirm or deny that. I'm just saying
you mean the ones with like a hot tub and a slide in
Yes, those.
That are on Route 6. I drive by those places and I'm like, even if I was going to go there, I would want it to be a little more romantically set than, you know, next to a strip mall. I just can't get it on if I'm like hearing my neighbors drive by.
Maybe not getting it on, but if you're spelunking for pleasure, that's the place you want to be.
I thought Eric was going to introduce himself as somebody who plays by the rules, because that's an ad campaign that we're hearing these days, too. But let's start here today, guys. On planes, trains, and automobiles, you won't have to wear a mask. As of Tuesday, a judge said those rules were an overreach. And so midday, sometimes mid-flight, as people got the news, they cheered or grimaced. The news click we did at WGNradio.com, our daily web poll question, found that our listeners were one-third happy, one-third angry, one-third indifferent about this. What was kind of annoying to me about this story is how narrowly the judge interpreted the law that allows the government to keep us safe. Justice Catherine Kimball Mizell said the 1944 statute can regulate sanitation measures to combat communicable diseases. But sanitation essentially means cleaning. And she said wearing a mask cleans nothing. At most, it traps virus droplets. So what we've been doing, forcing people to wear masks or removing those folks from places if they don't, is akin, she said, to detention and quarantine, which the law does not allow. So activist judge, she is not. There's a very strict interpretation of the rules, and the masks are off. Now, John, what do you think about that?
Well, I fall into a camp that I'm happy with the idea of not having to wear masks anymore. Well, of course, recognizing their importance when, you know, the numbers are high, because I know Heather's going to yell at me in a second if I don't specify that. Sorry, Heather. but I didn't like the ruling. And she also talked about how masks only keep the particles of the virus inside the mask. I'm like, that's the point of the mask. I wonder, it puts the Biden administration in an interesting spot, right? She's almost given cover to the Biden administration to now allow things to go back to normal, which a lot of people have been crying for. But this narrow ruling does set up an interesting precedent moving forward. So does the Biden administration want to challenge the ruling just to get another judge's eyes or an appellate court's eyes on this thing to wipe it away? I don't know. But I fall in the camp of I'm happy for it.
I think they do. I think they do want to challenge this ruling. And even though I think they were a couple of weeks away from removing the mask mandate anyway, but you have to make sure that you create the lines of authority going forward. You need to know whether you can do this or not. And you can't rely on this one judge. I think you do, because we may well come back into another. I mean, there's new variant out here. It's supposed to be many more times contagious, much more viral. So if we've got this new variant coming and we go back into this pandemic, we got to know whether the government has the authority to do these kind of mandates and to leave this question hanging, even if they don't want to enforce it, even if they want to take their victory and say, OK, fine, we'll put this in our back pocket. I think we need to have clarity on this. I think it would be really foolish of them to just kind of shrug and go away.
Okay, that's interesting. So you imagine a scenario where they challenge it, win, but don't reinstitute the mask rule, right?
I do, yes. Right now, I do.
Well, that seems to be responsible, even if politically perilous. I mean, Austin, you do that, you might lose both ways. I mean, aren't there political consequences to that?
Well, I guess the idea, though, would be, say, there's a new variant or something that pops up. You do want to have clear lines on what your authority is. My reading was it was struck down essentially on two tracks of thinking. One was that it violated the Administrative Procedures Act, which is essentially the rulemaking process. That's the act, if you remember, the Trump travel ban was struck down for not following the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act. So that's one track. To my non-legal mind, that seems like a correct reading of the law. The second reason it was struck down, though, is more murky and I think potentially dubious, which is that, no, the Biden administration didn't have statutory authority to do this in the first place. And so what Eric is saying is the Biden administration wants clarity on, do they have the statutory authority to do this in the first place? I do think it could be construed as a political win for the Biden administration because it ends a policy that, depending on what you look at, maybe was unpopular with a non-zero segment of even Democrats who are traveling. So ultimately, I don't think this sort of stuff matters in November. One, I don't think people are going to remember it. And two, I think there's really going to be a really big swing kind of regardless of what the Biden administration does at this point. So I don't know how much this sort of stuff matters.
I was just going to say that it's almost exactly what happened here in Illinois with the school mask mandate. So if you remember, there was a downstate judge that issued a somewhat legally questionable ruling, basically striking down the governor's authority to order students and staff in schools to wear a mask. And the governor appealed that order and got essentially an appellate court ruling that decision needed to stand. And then he appealed that decision to the state Supreme Court that basically said, no, that was not a good ruling. And then Pritzker immediately said, great, thanks, appreciate your service. The mask mandate is over. This whole case is moot. And it's as if that first court ruling never existed because of the action of the Supreme Court. And I think that's almost exactly what the Biden administration is hoping to do here, because the governor's office was very clear that their main goal was not to force kids to keep wearing masks in school, but was to preserve their ability to order them to do so if the pandemic takes off again. And I think that's exactly what the Biden administration wants to do here, which is why you saw yesterday a statement from the Department of Justice saying that they plan to appeal the decision, but would only do so if the CDC that it said a mask mandate on public transportation was medically necessary, essentially. So they want to preserve that ability, regardless of whether people should wear masks or not.
But why would they want to wait until an emergency moment in order to get a ruling from a court? Courts take time.
They don't want an emergency ruling because it's basically a different standard. So they're going to appeal. But what they didn't want to do is sort of say, we need a ruling on this right now, because the burden to overturn a lower court decision is higher in those cases. Essentially, you're saying, my pants are on fire, I need an emergency bucket of water. It's just a different legal standard that they have to meet. So they're happy to sort of let sort of cooler heads prevail and then, you know, have a appellate court judge basically say that ruling didn't make any sense. It doesn't exist. And then the Biden administration, just like Governor Pritzker, is going to declare victory and move on.
Well, if I can say, but my pants are on fire, will you please go to Home Depot and get a bucket and fill it with water? I mean, because these things take time. If a government wants to impose a mask mandate suddenly when there's if you remember 2 years ago when this crisis first blew onto us, there were major developments right away to try to control the spread. If there's a ruling by public health officials that we need to take immediate, severe, drastic action, but we have to wait to overturn some Florida judge's rule.
Yeah, but hold on, Eric.
That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying the Biden administration wants a ruling now that this Florida judge's ruling was incorrect. So they want to be able to have that authority so that if it is an emergency, they can issue a mask mandate. What they don't want to do is they want this normal appeals process to play out, because they're not arguing that it's an emergency right now, because I think they think that either they can't justify it at this exact moment, or they don't want to meet that legal burden. Not in those discussions.
Yeah, so I think that the only way to be really unpopular, I agree with Austin that most people won't care, The only way they could mess it up is if they do file an emergency order that would really show that they wanted those masks back on the plane. I think they're fine. Like Heather says, just to wait it out.
But there were no major outbreaks of COVID connected to people flying on airplanes, right? Somebody suggested to me today that the reason for that is because people were wearing masks, even if infrequently you were generally masked up on airplanes. If you flew in the last 2 years, my experience was they monitored that pretty closely, Heather.
I have no trust in contact tracing that data. I think that COVID, especially after Omicron and Delta, was so contagious that it became almost impossible to figure out where people contracted COVID, especially when we were in the middle of the Delta surge and 100 times more when we were in the middle of the Omicron surge. So I think it's impossible to tell. I think, honestly, it's probably far more likely that, you know, somebody will get COVID on the CTA where they're jammed into a car close and personal, you know, with 50 of their personal friends than they are on an airplane where everybody's got their own seat and there's much more sort of air circulation. But I just don't think we know enough about how people got sick, because there were so many people getting sick and our healthcare infrastructure is still very, very poorly equipped to handle an airborne infectious disease.
Well, were you guys like this at all? I was like, I am going to fly in June. I really wanted the mask mandate to go away. The mask mandate has gone away. And now I'm like, no, I don't want to get on the I want the mask mandate to end for me, but not for everybody else on the airplane.
No, I'm a reasonable human, John.
I wanted the judge to say, however, John Williams, you don't have to wear a mask because you've been a good citizen. But now it's a little scary to be in that tube with all those unmasked people. So now,
well, speaking of the court decisions, that's like what the other Illinois court decisions were. If you remember Darren Bailey, that the judge struck down mandates just for him, or like just for some students who were plaintiffs, right? So maybe you could sue.
That is so true. I want to talk about Willie Wilson just briefly, because it gets me also to Lori Lightfoot. Willie Wilson will give away gas again for the third time. The rich philanthropist businessman now running for mayor is going to give away gas, $1 million again this Saturday. We don't know where yet, right? But we do know that as an announced candidate, it is easier and I would say even wiser to look at his motives more closely. Ditto the fact that some of the gas stations that have been pumping gas for him have been making campaign contributions to an ally of his. Where did some of them were giving money to who again, guys? Did you notice that?
It was reporting from Cranes. My friend Justin Lawrence reported that it was Richard Boykin, who's running for Kick County Board President, while serving as Willie Wilson's spokesperson, a dual role that I have not yet been able to get my head around. But he was basically getting contributions from these gas station owners that were participating in the giveaway.
And in an unrelated matter, the city voted to give away via lottery gas and Ventra cards. They have lowered the income threshold and weighted the lottery to favor people on the south and west sides. I say unrelated because I don't think that's the mayor in response to or in anticipation of Willie Wilson. I still don't see him as a serious candidate. Austin, how do you score all of the gas giveaways?
I thought Greg Pratt's story in the Tribune was really good, especially because he quoted a lot of sort of campaign finance experts and they kind of just threw up their hands and were like, yeah, this is a little unseemly, but what law could you possibly pass that would make any sense to prevent stuff like this? Like, can candidates not give to charity? And I think the perfect example actually is what Lightfoot is doing, what Mayor Lightfoot is doing, where you have someone giving away his own money for publicity, I'm sure is one reason. Secondary reason might be he just wants to help people. The mayor is giving away our money for the same reason, to get votes and to get publicity around it. So I think it'd be a complete double standard for any sitting politician in Chicago or Illinois to call him out for vote buying when that sort of behavior, giving out these flashy giveaways or putting your names on things, or I remember a really common thing in the previous Daley administration was people who wanted city contracts would give large donations to nonprofits that were favored by the mayor's office, for example. That's another example of philanthropy being used, you know, for other means. So I thought that was a really good story. And maybe the best quote from it was from the infamous Ricky Hendon, who is a, I guess, another Wilson spokesperson or has been generally associated with Wilson in the past. And his quote was, "They've accused this man of buying votes. And I just have to say it, buying votes on the West Side, South Side, votes are about $5, $10. So if Willie Wilson is giving someone $3,000, I'd say you're overpaying by 1,500%. Very Chicago quote.
Yeah, I think that the power of incumbency is that ability that Austin's always talked, that I was just talking about, the ability to stamp your name on things and make it look like you're doing things for political reasons, or not for political reasons, for the good of the community, but you're actually doing it for political reasons. I think giving away free gas makes Willie Wilson now even more qualified to run for mayor of Chicago. but I don't know. It's a lot like with the campaign finance people. It doesn't feel right. Feels a little gross. But what are you going to do about it, right? Well, and at the end of the day, he's helping people that need it.
Well, Austin makes a great point. And I heard the term thrown around, stunt philanthropy, which is what Wilson is engaged in here. And he's doing it on Saturday morning this time, which is nice. The previous two giveaways have been on weekdays.
Rush hour.
Which caused these traffic snarls. So, you know, he's maybe wised up a little bit and realized that he's not going to get the negative publicity if he does it on a Saturday. People were saying, like, why not give out gift cards? And he was thinking, well, you can forge gift cards. Well, you know, he wants the attention. He's getting the attention. We're giving him the attention right here. I don't think it's going to translate into much more than the support that he has. But as we've said before on this podcast, we're going to have a bunch of mayoral candidates, probably, you know, five or six serious ones anyway. And they're going to be splitting the vote, and Lightfoot may really need those supporters of Willie Wilson, and she may not get them. It may be, you know, like I said, 15% of the voters turn out and vote for Willie Wilson. He may not win. He probably won't win, but he could seriously damage Mayor Lightfoot.
Do you think Mayor Lightfoot would be endorsing this campaign, putting this campaign forward of giving people venture cards and gas cards if she weren't running for re-election, Eric?
If she weren't running for re-election, I'm not sure. I would say
I would like yes. to think she would.
I would like to think she would. Although, you right. know, I'm still a little skeptical of this idea of giving people money to buy gas. That might be much better to give more money for public transit. You could make people a little bit more sure of what's going on the CTA to encourage use of transit. I don't know about I'm a little skeptical. I'm all for safety net stuff, but I'm skeptical of this idea of handing out $50 cards to people by lottery. It seems like a strange allocation of resources.
Well, you don't have enough, I guess, to give it to everybody. So it's a lottery. So some people who should not get it are just randomly going to get it. I just wanted, John, you to comment also on the – I forget exactly how you put it, but I think – when Lori Lightfoot says, "I'm going to do this," she's not giving away money. She's giving back money. I mean, it is money that people have – maybe it was your point, Austin. People have paid in taxes. So that Lori Lightfoot is doing it isn't her giving the stuff away. It's her giving the money back. I sort of appreciate that.
It's not her money. That's the thing with – like Wilson has some skin in the game. I'm great at giving away other people's money. I'm extremely benevolent in that sense. The Wilson stuff, it's costing him. This costs Lori Lightfoot nothing.
Yeah, that's why I asked Eric if she would be doing this if it weren't an election period. And take Willie Wilson out of it generally. If the city has money and the people are struggling, then of course the mayor should give the people some of their money back. It's not so calculated that way. Or there's, you know, the motivation seems to be genuine when the mayor's giving taxpayers their tax dollars back. She should be doing that. I guess that's my point. She should be doing that. And why are we looking at her motives when she does? Better that she hold on to that money? No, it's our money. Give us some of our money back.
Why restrict it, though, then to transportation costs? Just give people their money back.
Maybe so. I think that's why I'm also asking if she would be doing this at all. were it not for the election. Eric, you were going to say something?
Well, certainly there are a lot of people who don't have cars. And so they're not eligible for this particular giveaway. And I like the idea of tackling the problem, making sure that those who are seriously impacted by the rising prices, by whatever economic stresses there are dealt with, are helped. I think that the more random you make it, the more you run the risk that you're giving the money to people who don't need it the most. And that's, I think, a poor use of government resources at that point.
I'm so surprised that this really, I think, shows you how people like Andrew Yang really shifted the Overton window on cash assistance for people. Because if we had not gone through a Democratic primary where people were talking about like universal basic income and like the need to just give people cash to get them out of poverty has completely changed the debate. So I don't know if I think it's worth bearing in mind that Lightfoot's first proposal to deal with gas, with the rising cost of gas, was to take 3 cents off the city's share of the gas tax and not to give people cash. So I think that when it was clear that A, that wasn't going to make it through the city council, and B, was probably going to run afoul of the constitutional amendment that requires gas tax funds to be used for transportation projects. So, you know, obviously I can't see it to her mind or heart or soul, probably for the benefit of everybody involved. I just think that it's a really fascinating new approach that politicians now take to people facing financial crises. I am not sure that it has 26 votes in the city council next week. It passed out of the budget committee on a 15-12 vote. That is very, very narrow. And it means that there are a significant number of older people who are opposed to it, really across the political spectrum. You have people like Alderman Brendan Riley, who's among the more conservative members of the city council, who objects to taxpayer funds being used to subsidize the purchase of gasoline, which is a polluting fossil fuel. And you have people on the more progressive side, like Carlos Ramirez Rosa, who see this only as a re-election gimmick that is designed to put a literal card of cash in voters' hands, you know, less than a year before they go to the polls to vote, not only for the mayor, but for their alderperson. And I think there is going to be a lot of pushback against that. It's also fascinating that these cards are set to have Mayor Lightfoot's name on them, because her entire pitch during the 2019 campaign was that she was going to root out corruption at City Hall. She was going to bring in the light. And there is nothing more machine politician, I have to say, than slapping your name on a piece of city infrastructure.
Well, and remember, didn't Donald Trump do that for the first stimulus check that came in as well? And he was the non-politician of them all. When they get in power, they just love to slap their name over everything.
That is so true.
It's just really fascinating to me that on some level, gas prices and the cost of inflation pose such a political problem to her that she's willing to sort of raise these questions about her commitment to reform and good government and sort of say, I helped when you were struggling. And that's, you know, a very powerful argument for people, especially those that I like to affectionately call normies, who don't follow this every second of every day like I do.
Well, what do we think about the aldermen, the individual alder person's ability to, we talked about this last week, but I've heard pros and cons on this, their ability to keep the casino from going into one of the three locations. Is that still going to fall under aldermanic privilege? Do we still think that's going to, one, those individuals are going to be the gatekeepers on this? Somebody sort of brushed that aside. Another reporter this week, when I asked them about it, they said, this is too big. It's too visible. The mayor is too vested in this. It's not just going to be at the whim of the one alderman or, you know, for each of the three sites. What's the thought on that today?
Well, the way I was reading the coverage this week, I think there's a pretty good story in the Sun-Times about this, was that you've got NIMBY aldermen in every ward essentially saying, no, too much crime, too much traffic, my residents don't want this. And I'm wondering, what is the way around this if you're going to honor aldermanic privilege? or prerogative. You have to say at some point, look, and I think Mayor Lightfoot has said this, which is there are some things that are way bigger than this, simply the ward that they're in. That the, she says the city needs this. It really needs this tax revenue. And we can't be kowtowing to every little neighborhood group that worries about traffic. And I mean, I think in general, you know, irrespective of the merits of the casino proposal or anything else, that that is a very strong argument that you have to have some sort of central leadership for major projects. You cannot give these people with a 1/50th control over the population say so on major projects that are very important to the future of the city.
Well, you shouldn't, but we always have. And I wonder, and John and Austin, I'd like to see your feedback on this too. Maybe it's easier to exercise that sort of prerogative over a permit for a shoe store, but something this big is in fact the reason that the thing has to go away, because it is in fact too important. John, you were going to say what?
Yeah, it makes no sense when I explain it out, but I don't mind my alderman having control over the shoe store or the signs, or if they can fix the light pole in front of my building versus someone else. Like, that I don't mind, but for the casino, I almost – can't they just carve out a – is O'Hare technically an award, Heather, do you know?
It is.
Okay. Well, we should have some things we carve out that are not in wards that are owned by everybody, and the city council as a whole has to control what happens
there. It's the District of Columbia. It'll be its own little thing. Austin, you like that idea? It was problem solved.
I've never thought of that. We have like an autonomous zone or something like that. That's cool. Like there's, I remember in Copenhagen, there's a neighborhood called Christiania where there's basically no laws. And it's kind of cool. So maybe we could do that. Maybe that could be the 78 actually would be a good setting for that. Like we should just make the 78 that. But I think so. Here's the way that this happens while honoring aldermanic privilege. And here's the way that it always happens with that while honoring aldermanic privilege. You build it in an alderman's ward who's being paid off by whoever benefits from building it there. That's what happens. And what I don't like when people defend aldermanic privilege is like, yeah, maybe your alderman stopped something you didn't like, or maybe they picked up your trash. But everywhere else in the city, including in your ward, most likely, aldermen go to prison for getting bribed to make those decisions. A lot. We just had a great report from the BGA. Rachel Hinton had a great report on Alderman Walter Burnett, who basically got a ton of money from developers, changed his stance completely on affordable housing. So when you have this choke point, it is like almost universally corrupted. So yeah, you might get a couple of decisions you like, but you know, over the course of time, the arc bends towards corruption, like inevitably.
But also, if I get my shoe store, what do I care if that alderman ends up in prison later? I'm just going to ask the next guy or gal for something else.
Make sure the awning doesn't go too far over the sidewalk.
And oh, John that's Hansen the sort of
John,
thing.
John Hansen is happy.
But do you honestly think people care if their aldermen go to prison? I'm serious. Do you think anyone really cares that their alderman was corrupt and goes to prison?
Well, if they make a deal that instead of a shoe store, they put a Taco Bell next to your house, John, maybe you would.
Maybe. Some people like that. You know what I'm saying? I think this is why we don't rise up as Chicagoans every time there's a story about an alderman being indicted. Well, of course, those of us who care about local government and the sanctity of it hate it. I just don't think people care.
Well, we made this point last week, which is that aldermanic privilege or prerogative is not written into the law, so that changing it, you can't say, well, this law no longer applies, because it's not a law, it's a custom.
But so you can when it comes to zoning, though. So like aldermen still have this actual in the law power that the council is going to vote on these zoning changes,
right?
And it's only under the auspices of that this custom is able to arise. In other cities, the buildings department or some other office of the executive branch is making these decisions and not city council. So there are statutory changes that you could make.
So you could carve out, say, major zoning changes while still maybe leaving in shoe stores and awnings and so on.
Yeah, Heather? I mean, the laws can be whatever you want them to be. The problem is that, so let's say the council as a whole wants the casino to go with the 78, which would be in the 25th ward, represented by Alderman Byron Sigcho Lopez. And they don't particularly care that he opposes it, right? He's a freshman alderman. He's a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. Maybe he doesn't have a lot of clout or pull at City Hall. But at some point, each of them, before casting that vote, is going to ask themselves, am I setting a precedent? So the next mayor, or even this mayor, maybe they think the city needs a steel plant. Maybe they think they need a pollution spewing asphalt plant. Maybe that mayor doesn't like me just the way that we don't really like Byron Sigcho Lopez, and they put this in my ward, and I'm responsible for the destruction of the quality of life in my ward, and I won't be able to stop it. And I guarantee each of those older people are going to have a bracing come to Jesus or whatever deity they pray to moment and think 3, 4, 5 times about that, because if they are setting a precedent that says I will vote to put the casino wherever I think is best, even if it's not in my ward, I cannot tell you what a sea change of politics that would be in Chicago. And it would fundamentally change the nature of the way that the city council operates, where the benefit of neighborhoods are prioritized over the benefit of the
you
city.
You don't think a casino is sufficiently different from even the asphalt plant and the steel mill? It's a casino. There's not going to be any more casinos. We're only going to have one casino. This is a one-off. You don't think it's singular that way, Heather?
I think my analogy to an asphalt plant, I think, is right on, because there will be impacts with the casino, right? There's going to be traffic. There's going to be potentially an attraction for maybe people who I don't want in my residential neighborhood around my kids. It's going to be, to some people, what they call an attractive nuisance, right? And if you can argue that the economic benefit of a casino is so great to the city as a whole that the 25th ward or the 11th ward or the 41st ward has to suck it up, that's going to make each of those aldermen thinking, what precedent am I setting that will potentially mean that I will never be reelected and it will destroy the quality of life in my ward? Because I'm listening to Alderman Sigcho Lopez saying that's what I'm doing to the 25th ward. I don't think that's an easy vote. Even if you have the mayor saying we've got $200 million on the line here.
That just sounds like self-preservation. That does not sound like neighborhood preservation or city preservation. That just sounds to me like individual preservation.
I know, politics is shocking, right, John?
Austin, talk to us about today's date. If marijuana is on people's minds, it used to be so much more fun when it was illegal. The conversations about 420 and the jokes and all of that. But now it's legal. The city and state are involved. How is Illinois doing? You guys did a report on that, right?
Yeah. So bottom line, we brought in $317 million in revenue in 2021 from marijuana taxes. I think for the 4 years or so I worked at the Illinois Policy Institute before this passed, maybe the most common comment on any piece of budget and tax research we would put out was just legalize marijuana. That'll fix it. Like, there'll be all this money. Well, they projected $500 to $700 million in revenue at this point. So we're coming in far below what the proponents of this projected. And the reasons for this are overtaxation of the product relative to other states and overregulation, which is now becoming the subject of a lot of lawsuits. So Illinois has the most restrictive licensing regime of any state. This is not to say our safety standards are more stringent or anything like that. It is simply the number of licenses we give out for people to produce and sell this stuff compared with our population. It is far more restrictive than any other state. We have the third highest average effective tax rate. And I believe a lawsuit that was just filed alleges we have a pound of marijuana going for around $4,000 compared with $300 in a market like California. So why are these rules so restrictive? That's another question.
What does your weed guy sell it for?
I don't know what a pound goes for on the black market. That's a good question, but I'm sure it's less than $4,000.
Well, that's the problem.
Yeah, which is a big problem. If you overtax the stuff, the price difference on black market is so great that the black market not only continues, but it can thrive and grow.
Did any of the overtax and overregulation, though, was that necessary in order to placate enough people to allow the bill to pass in the first place? Meaning we're dealing with the ramifications of what the bill needed to get across the finish line.
I don't think so, because this is such a politically popular issue. So I was recently working down on a campaign in Mississippi on medical marijuana. And what you may not know is that in 2020, there was a ballot initiative in Mississippi to legalize recreational marijuana. It passed with 74% of people in Mississippi voting yes. It beat Trump by like 12, 15 points. Medical marijuana. This is broadly across parties. This is something people want.
So is it medical marijuana or
recreational? That was medical, not recreational.
Okay. Oh, wow.
But they don't have that still yet? It's Mississippi. You know, it's you would not expect this necessarily. So now we have a lot of these lawsuits coming out. There's just one this week alleging there's a small band of companies colluding to control prices because of this restrictive licensing regime. So, John, I think what happened was, and what happens with things like gambling, all these vices that are legalized, it's essentially you're bribing all of these insider constituencies to get it passed because they see a huge pot of money that's about to be there. And Illinois is great at that. So, you know, there was a lot of horse trading to get this passed to make sure allies of Madigan, allies of Pritzker, allies of legislative leadership got their pound of flesh. And I think we're seeing the consequences of that in this really inefficient market right now.
One part of the report, I was just scanning it here, I read it, it's very interesting, but it mentions, I believe, that certain states, Colorado, I think is one of them, don't have any limits on the number of licenses that are given out, that the licenses are, I mean, we have this incredibly Byzantine and restrictive system of giving out licenses, and other states don't seem to have a problem giving out these licenses. And I had the same question that John Hansen had, which was, you know, did we have to do this in order to get it through the legislature? And therefore, throwing this forward, you look at the shortfall and you estimate, the Illinois Policy Institute estimates that we've lost $600 million because of the way our legal marijuana laws were structured. Throwing it forward, it really is time to look at best practices in other states and adopt some or all of those in order to recoup some of this money, because otherwise we're falling behind per capita revenues in a really serious way.
Yeah, I wonder, because I think it's like, it's obviously very popular that it's passed in Illinois, and like, I'm happy that it passed and I don't even use the stuff. Can we fix these things now, Austin? Is there political will now to go back and say, okay, well, we've taxed it too high? Is there any momentum for that?
Tough to say. This is an industry where there are maybe, say, 50 companies that care a lot about the wording of two sentences in Illinois statute, right? And in situations like that, where there are these really concentrated benefits and costs that are dispersed over the 12 million people in Illinois, like, it's going to be written for the benefit of insiders, which is, I really think, why a state like Colorado and some of these other states that have much simpler and less corrupt and more efficient ways to do this, it passed by citizen initiative first and not through the legislative process. In Illinois, it went through the dare I say, swamp of Springfield, and that's why this is the result.
The point I wanted to make is how we have failed completely still on equity, people that get to take part and own and be a part of this. I covered, and Block Club did a great job covering, this new program through UCAN and a couple other neighborhood organizations. Basically, Olivet Nazareth has a program. They're aiming to get an associate's degree, but right now they have a program where they teach people how to become entrepreneurs in this. And through scholarships, they're giving a lot of people who have been imprisoned because of marijuana laws, draconian marijuana laws, $1,000 to spend however they want, whether it's towards the program. And most of these people are spending it on their legal fees to expunge their records, because everything that they're learning about being a marijuana entrepreneur, they still can't work in a dispensary. They still can't do any of these things that they're being taught. So we're trying to get them to be entrepreneurs, but their past legal efforts and their past legal things that have been going on prevent them from doing it. It's just like the most backwards thing.
The law precludes them from working in the industry, huh?
From growing, from being owners, from anything.
I remember when the lines, what was it, January 1st of 2020? Was that when they were the first purchases were made? Was it 2020 that it first went into effect, right?
It was, yeah.
And people were showing us their receipts. And the number that jumped out at me was the amount of tax that people were paying per purchase. And I thought that, you know, would bode well for the state. I'm pleased that you guys did the reporting. I didn't realize that we were being that inefficient about it or leaving that much money on the table. And every now and then when it comes up on the radio, people will say, I'm still buying from my guy because I'm paying too much at these places. I don't know if the lawmakers anticipated that or if they didn't care, if that was just going to be a sort of natural consequence of transitioning from an illegal business to now a state-controlled legal business, that some people would still stay with the guy. But Austin, did you guys have any sort of reporting about how much street sales are still taking place that we're leaving there?
It's really tough to estimate, and we did not send out like interns to go look at how much they could buy weed for on the street. So, no, what you really see happen, it's a really cool economics lesson because there's a theory first proposed by Art Laffer, an economist. It's called the Laffer curve, and essentially imagine an upside down U, and you at a certain point you can tax something so high that you get less tax revenue because people go to alternatives. They won't demand as much. So that's what's happened. Like, people might be confused saying, how did we bring in less revenue than expected, yet the taxes are so high? Well, really, really high taxes on stuff have other effects, one of which is people don't buy it or they buy it from another source.
My guess is that if the rules don't change, that you're going to see a greater effect of that, because as people get more comfortable with the idea of marijuana, that there are people who dip their toe in because it was legal,
right,
and then they realize, man, these taxes are really high, and the guy down the street sells it, and the social stigma, the legal problems you would face if you were to be caught buying weed from your weed guy are minimal anymore. So I can see where this rush toward the black market would be accelerated by these high taxes.
That's what they found in California, and the concept is called induced demand. That you, by legalizing it, it's not just neutral. There's new demand for this product, exactly like you said.
We get so many things wrong in this state. Damn. it's like, what do we do? I want you guys to do some in-depth study and say, here's something Illinois is just knocking it out of the park. You're doing a great job.
Does anything come? Austin, I want to see that.
What comes to mind? I want a
list. I'll come back. At the top of my head, I can't think of anything, but I'll come back with some stuff.
Well. Top 10 things Illinois is really doing well tonight on WTTW.
Soybeans.
Well, okay, fine.
Corn.
I'll take two. There's two right there. John Hansen, you were wondering if athletes from Russia should be banned from sporting events, right?
That feels icky to me. Wimbledon
They were not allowed to run in the Boston Marathon. Belarusians were not allowed to run the Boston Marathon this week. They got in on the Olympics, but not the Paralympics. Kazan, Russia is going to be the site of the Special Olympics in 2023, and now they pulled it from there because of the war in Ukraine. I think any Russian participating in anything outside of Russia should be canceled. I don't even think we should allow the sale of medical supplies in Russia from American companies. I'm very dark about this thing, John. I have no sympathy for those people.
Okay.
Let me take that back. I have sympathy for those people, but I think this is the price they have to pay, and I'm sorry about that. Go ahead.
Business is making money, fine. Hosting events, fine. I'm with you there, but average citizens, well, I guess superb athletic citizens, it just doesn't stick very right with me. And I think that it's a punishment that makes us feel good without actually doing anything. And you do miss out on moments, as we've seen in other sports events, where athletes protest their own leaders at events and hold up signs saying no war. And those have actually turned out to be way more in terms of propaganda on our side. So I don't get punishing individuals for that. I don't think it hurts Russia at all. I don't think it changes the outcome of what's happening. And the way that businesses and sanctions do. So I guess I don't know where I fall on it. It just feels icky to me to say you can't play in Wimbledon because you come because your leader's a dictator who invades.
Number two male player in the world, right, is a Russian right now and is not going to be allowed to participate at Wimbledon. And I think the French is going to happen before that, right? So it'll be interesting to see what the other Grand Slam tournaments do. Eric, are you with me or John Hansen on this one?
I think I'm a little bit more with John Hansen on this because I feel like it may actually breed more hostility and resentment within Russia among just ordinary people when they see people who they consider to be innocent victims of Putin being punished yet again, right? I mean, that a lot of these athletes are not political. And if you have somebody who has been outwardly and brazenly pro-Putin, then are gratuitously pro-Putin, let's say. You can't really ask him to speak negatively of Putin when they live in Russia. But just to be punishing everyday athletes, it does seem like it's a bit much. So I guess I'm with John Hansen on this.
How about you, Heather or Austin? Do you have a dog in this hunt?
I do not. I mean, the most formative experience of sanctions for me was when the Iraqi people were suffering under the sanctions in the wake of the first Gulf War. And I was in college at the time, and there was a lot of activism that I covered as a Bebe journalist at Northwestern about sort of how those sanctions weren't hurting people like Saddam Hussein and his cronies, but that it was making it impossible for parents to feed their children and, you know, sort of, you know, live a life with a reasonable standard of living. And, I don't know the right answer because, you know, it's clear that in an authoritarian country like Russia, you can't really separate the government from the people because the government controls everything. But at the same time, if we want the war in Ukraine to stop because people are suffering, it seems reductive and self-defeating to cause more suffering to do that.
It's one way to get the word back. Like, if we all just say, well, golly, it's not the tennis player's fault, right? Then we're missing an opportunity to let the Russian people, for one thing, I wonder what the Russian people go, hey, how come the guy can't be in the Paralympics? How come the guy can't be at Wimbledon? How come the guy can't run Boston Marathon? Oh, because the whole world has decided that we are wrong. So I wonder if that would filter through those Russian vodka-soaked brains, and they go, oh, well, maybe we're doing something wrong. Maybe we're doing something wrong.
Well, I think a lot of people do think that, but there's still this fear. Like, what are they going to do? I mean, I guess, you know, early on we were seeing images out of Moscow and St. Petersburg of riots, or excuse me, protests. I haven't seen any since, and I don't know if it's because they've lost interest in doing that, if they've been brainwashed, or if the resistance that the government puts on those people has been the most effective chilling effect. So I just don't see a Wimbledon player or not being the straw that breaks the camel's back. But I guess your point is, John, that every straw is important in this fight.
The New York Times has done a significant amount of reporting on this, and they say that this sort of approach has in some ways helped Putin because he relies significantly on his ability to sort of cultivate this sense of victimhood, and that sort of banning people from, you know, performing Tchaikovsky and playing Wimbledon, you know, reinforces that sense that Putin is standing against the West and that without Putin, the West would destroy Russia and its culture. And I that makes sense to me, right? Because if you can create an us versus them sort of approach to it all, you lose the ability to sort of reach people because they've already been told, well, you just hate Russia. And so I think it's there's no way to know. And there's no right or wrong answer, although you can always err on not calling people of a certain ethnicity having brains that are soaked with vodka, but that's just me.
I guess I was thinking of the soldiers because they say when they exit a town, you can tell that the drinking has been massive. And I wonder if that's just one of the ways they're sedating themselves to commit the sort of horrors that they are. And I also think that, you just are giving millions of people a pass then. You're saying your country, I'm sorry, it's Vladimir Putin, it's one guy, but that's your country. Your country is committing these atrocities, and we're just going to give the entire sweep of people there a pass, when in fact they are really one true way to end the war or to effect change. I don't know when and where their revolution
where
is going to happen.
John? I mean, you could talk about countries that have backwards policies on all sorts of rights that still compete in the Olympics. People that still put people to death for being gay and they get to compete in the Olympics. I'm not trying to compare the two because they are incomparable, but I just mean if we start banning certain athletes because of the country that they come from, you could certainly make arguments in other places too.
This sort of feels like the casino conversation, but maybe this is the one-off. This is different than the run-of-the-mill atrocities. Don't we think what is happening in Ukraine right now is extraordinary?
Yes.
And maybe the recriminations can be or might be extraordinary as well. I'm not saying never let the tennis player play tennis, but right now, if I had to react with my gut, forgive me for it if I'm doing that. Eric, you've been a little silent. Have I persuaded you over there to my side or not at all?
You're making some sense, John, I have to say. It's one of those things where, I think that Hansen's point about the fact that if we're going to apply these purity tests, there are a lot of countries that are very dreadful out there. And, it's hard to compare some of the things he's talking about with the kinds of awful war crimes that are now being committed by Russia. But you want to be, I think, very careful about punishing individual athletes, individual performers, especially like, people from Russia running the Boston Marathon. I mean, it just seems like at some point you do risk this backlash.
John, I do have a question for you to test your theory a little bit. I think that like with Wimbledon, it's such a big stage and it's an individual, right? That maybe the banning of that sends that message that you're trying to send. What about Alexander Ovechkin, who has played in the United States for so long as part of a team on the Washington Capitals as a superstar? Should a Russian on a group team, on a team sport, also not be able to play?
Well, it would help if he took the picture of him and Putin off of his Facebook page, because
I'll
take your point, but he's a bad example because he has been an ally of the of Putin and has prospered from it. But if it was neutral, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe so. Any last comments that any of you have before we wrap it up, Mr. Zorn or Heather?
Well, I want to say that I am going to be linking to this study about marijuana from the Illinois Policy Institute in tomorrow's edition of the Picayune Sentinel, where I also have a lengthy autobiographical piece about John Hansen.
And,
anyone wants to meet John Hansen, Picayune Sentinel tomorrow. Thursday, I should say, for people who listen to it then. And I interviewed John for, about an hour almost. And then I transcribed it loosely and sent it to him, and he fixed it. And it's real interesting. You'll find out about what John was like as a kid. And it won't surprise you.
I don't know what that means. Can you just share with us one tidbit? What's one morsel that will make us want to make sure we click through?
Well, the one thing that really struck me is that when he was a kid, that his parents gave him, now John, correct me if I get any of this wrong, but his parents like gave him a hand-me-down VHS camcorder, the ones with the huge VHS tape inside it, actually. And he took it to school and he started something called Channel 7 Soybean News, because he figured that soybeans were important to Illinois for some reason in his young creative mind. And he interviewed people on the playgrounds and did like a newscast at his school. And this was John Hansen in his formative years.
Wow.
Kind of like
Heather.
Heather was a nerdy kid as well. So,
and aspired to be a reporter someday too. I don't think I was that far thinking when I was that age.
The other detail I thought was hilarious was that John's dad is a firefighter. He's he runs the fire department in Lincolnwood, and he's got two brothers, and both of them wanted to be firefighters as a kid, and they dressed up as firefighters for Halloween. And John dressed up as Harry Carey for Halloween. His brothers wanted to rush into the burning building, and John wanted to rush over with a camera and a microphone to cover it. So, so there's lots more of John Hansen's story in the Picayune Sentinel tomorrow.
Thanks, Eric. Appreciate it.
All right. That's John. All that's true, I trust. John Hansen, Eric Zorn, Heather Sharone, Austin clicked out a minute ago. I'm John Williams. We are produced this week by Ashley Byhun and usually Pete Zimmerman, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.